Hi, this is Gary Lee Schwartz from the Solid Gold Jukebox, and you're listening to my very good friend, Mike Miller, on the Harmony Street Show. Hey, that's just the way we rehearsed it.
Hi, everybody, this is your cousin Brucey, and you're listening to my good friend, my cousin, Mike Miller, right here on the Harmony Street Radio Show.
Hi, this is Mary Wilson of the Supremes, and you're listening to my friend, Mike Miller, on the Harmony Street Show, and we just have so much fun, my baby love, me and Mike Miller. Woo!
Hey, Mike, John Mathis.
Hey, John, how are you?
I'm okay, thanks. It's Johnny Mathis, and you're listening to my good friend Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show.
Hi, this is Chuck Negron, formerly of Three Dog Men, and you're listening to my good friend Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show.
Hi, this is Ben E. King, and you're listening to my friend Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show.
Mike, this is Dan. Stay well. God bless.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's at this point bring up your hosts for the evening, and they've been doing the show since 6 o'clock tonight here, the Solid Gold Jukebox, heard every Friday night. And a big hand, please, for Rick McCaffrey and Gary Lee Schwartz.
Good evening, everyone. How are you? Everybody having a good time? Say hello to my uncle here, Gary Lee.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the New Paul's Grill. 10 years from now, you're still going to remember this concert as the best concert you've ever seen in your entire life. Johnny Maestro and the Brooklyn Bridge.
For this gentleman we're about to announce, it started in 1957 on Joyce Records with a little thing called My Juanita. You remember that, don't you? All right. So without further ado,
ladies and gentlemen, guys and gals, America's number one rock and roll doo-wop group, Johnny Maestro and the Brooklyn Bridge.
Right here, let's hear it.
Hi, this is Mike Miller, and you're here with me on the Harmony Street Show, and it's my extreme pleasure to have as my guest, R&B royalty, Miss Darlene Love. Hi, Darlene, how are you?
Hey, I'm good. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. You know, several years ago, we were actually on the Solid Gold Jukebox together with Rick McCaffrey and Gary Lee Schwartz, and it was a night where there were many people in the studio, and we had some good times and good talk. Do you remember that night?
It was upstate, right?
Yeah, that was upstate. That was in Poughkeepsie.
It's Jukebox Friday night with Rick McCaffrey and Gary Lee Schwartz.
We're a minute past 7 o'clock, and you haven't even introduced our special guest. Would you go ahead and do that,
okay,
please?
Okay.
Where have all the years gone, everybody?
We don't know, Gary Lee. Tell us.
Shut up. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to An Evening of Love, starring Miss Darlene Love. Her new book, My Name is Love, is now in its second printing. Ladies and gentlemen, guys and gals, Rick McCaffrey, Gary Lee Schwartz, Oldies 97, welcome the undisputed goddess of rock and roll, Miss Darlene Love.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Mike Miller, and you're here with me on the Harmony Street Show, and it's my pleasure to have as my guests, my longtime friends, aficionados of our genre, radio gurus, and two of the guys that really helped put my Harmony Street group on the map, the boys from the Solid Gold Jukebox, Mr. Rick McCaffrey, and the oh-so-colorful Mr. Gary Lee Schwartz. How you doing, guys?
Good, Mike. Mike, it's a pleasure to be speaking with you on your show. We waited a long time to be able to do this because of our schedule and your schedule being so crazy.
Right. Well, we go back a long time. I just wanted to go back to the very beginning and get into this. I know that people that are in the music business that embrace it, as you guys have done for all of your adult life, usually find the music early on in their life. So, Rick, I want to ask you, you were born and raised where, Rick?
Well, I was born in actually Peekskill in Westchester County, Peekskill, New York, and moved to Poughkeepsie, New York. My father was an IBMer, and he commuted for a while. Then when I was 8, we moved to Poughkeepsie, and I was raised in Poughkeepsie.
Yeah, interesting, because my younger days, junior high school and elementary school, were actually in Armonk, and I watched IBM go in. Now, in your family, were there people that were musical in your family?
No, I don't remember anybody really musical in my family. I have an older sister, 4 years older than I am, and she was a big collector of music. And when she was out, I used to sneak in her room and grab her 45s and go in my room, even with an 8 and 9 year old kid, and spin some of her records. So, it was basically that. Of course, the DJs that I listened to, and I remember one Christmas getting a, it was a little toy set. It had a speaker and a microphone, and in my bedroom, actually, where the stairways, there was the doorway that went up to the attic. And I used to have my younger sister, 4 years younger, and I would send her up in the attic with the speaker, and I'd be down in my room with the microphone, and I'd be doing a DJ show playing records
on
my little record player, and she'd be up in the attic listening to my DJ show. So, I was about 9, 10 years old, something like that.
So you started the DJ thing early on, like I used to take my father's tennis racket and stand on the bed and pretend I was playing the guitar and singing. So, you know, that stuff comes early. Now, I found my mother threw a Motorola a little transistor into my bed because I was such a rotten kid and she used to want to pacify me. But I found that I wound up turning that dial all the way to the end. And I was listening to the R&B and the group harmony when I was like 4, 5, and 6 years old instead of listening to the Kalin twins. So, you know, I grew up probably probably around 11 years old, I knew all the words to all the R&B groups, the Harptones, the Nutmegs, and all of that stuff. So I'm assuming that you guys pretty much found that music on your own as well.
I did. I remember getting a transistor for my birthday, which is in summer. And shortly after that, I think in the fall, I started my first job was as a paper boy. I was about 12 years old for the local newspaper,
right,
which was delivered in the afternoon. So after school, my buddy who lived across the street from me, he and I would go out with the papers and we'd deliver the newspapers. And we did that for several years and always brought the transistor radios with us, listening to the music and singing to all the songs. And, it's a vivid memory I have.
Wow.
Hearing a certain song for the very first time and then wishing you could hear it again right away.
Oh, yeah. You know, it lights you up. I want to ask Gary. Gary, you were born and raised where?
I was born in the Bronx, and then when my father started his own business, we moved up to Yonkers, New York when I was 9 years old.
Right. So your father used to drive you up and down Central Avenue and you used to pass Corvettes
Oh, sure. EJ Corvettes,
yeah.
Ed Klein's.
Right.
Way before the Caldor days.
Right.
And, all the stores that are active now are, much different than the early days. Alexander's in the Bronx,
right. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, in your family, like when you were young, did you have the same experience as Rick and I as far as just finding that music on your own and just falling in love with it instantly?
Well, no one in my family was musically inclined. At the age of 9, I went to my first Alan Freed show in Manhattan.
Right.
I was listening to my transistor radio in my room. I was playing records, and my father and mother was thinking of sending me to a psychiatrist because they said a guy like you should be out playing ball with his friends instead of talking to your girlfriends on the phone and playing rock and roll records.
Right.
What the heck's the matter with you?
Right.
You know. So, and I also had a stuttering problem, unfortunately, but I overcame it before my bar mitzvah at the age of 13, and I'm kind of proud that a guy who stuttered actually went into marketing, broadcasting, rock and roll, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a nice accomplishment for a young man that did not know what was going to happen to his life.
I need to ask you, did you stutter through your bar mitzvah speech?
No, actually, I still remember my speech, by da bed, or vi la donoi. No, I did very well. I went to speech therapy. Didn't have to go to the psychiatrist, but music was my therapy of getting rid of my stutter. So as time goes on, Rick and I will tell you how much music did for us personally in our everyday lives.
I understand music has saved my life a couple of times, and believe it or not, you guys were there a couple of times when I needed my life saved. So, you know, that's how far we go back because we're very long-time friends. Now, when I was 12, 13, 14, 15, you know, I never missed a show with the Brooklyn Fox, you know, with Murray the K. And I know, Gary, that you were friendly with Murray, if I remember correctly.
Murray was a close friend and was a gentleman's gentleman. When I hear rock and roll artists criticize him, I always stick up for him. He was one of the most talented radio personality entertainers ever, and he always treated me like he would have treated someone in his family. He was just a terrific guy, and it was a pleasure to know him, meet him, and mourn him at the age of 60 when he passed away from a rare form of cancer in California. It was really sad to lose guys like Alan Freed and Murray the K.
Well, you know, it's really funny because I met a lady whose name was Jackie, and she was from New Jersey. And as we got to talking, she said to me, you know that I was with Murray when he died. And, of course, Murray had a slew of Jackies in his life, one of them being Jackie Zeman, who
I... Right, from the... soap opera, General Hospital.
Yeah, who I understand turned her back on him when he got sick, but that's another story, you know.
That is true.
Yeah.
She actually forgot about him, and a friend of Rick's and Gary Lee, who when I did the Joey Reynolds show, which we'll get into later, did some co-hosting for a couple of years for him, with him.
Right.
Ron Farber was one of the guys that was taking care of Murray. He was a friend of Rick and Gary Lee. And the man who gave Murray his money when he needed it, when he was dying, the guy that paid for his funeral was...
Tony Orlando.
Okay, right. What's that at this? Tony Orlando was the man that paid for Murray's funeral because, unfortunately,
right,
Murray was ripped off by a lot of people and was penniless when he died.
So, Gary, tell me how you got started actually sitting in front of the microphone and becoming a DJ.
Well, I went to broadcasting school while I was still going to college and working part-time in New York. For a couple of months, I had a job in 1966 at WBAB Radio in Babylon, Long Island.
Right.
I said it that, too.
I remember the station, yeah.
And it was a format where you could play and say whatever you wanted to do. Unfortunately, that didn't last too long. But I really got interested, as I mentioned, at 9 years old. I did a little early radio. And then in later years, I was with Rick for over 20 years. Rick and I accomplished a lot individually and together. I mean, if it wasn't for Rick, I probably would not have been in radio so long.
Right.
He encouraged me, and he was a great guy to put up with a lot of shtick and craziness from Gary Lee Schwartz.
Yeah, well, I want to ask Rick this, because I know that Rick is not only a seasoned DJ, but he's also an aficionado and a collector of the music. When did you first step in front of the microphone, Rick, and how did that happen?
Well, actually, after high school, I went to community college here in town, Dutchess Community College, Dutchess County. And during community college, they had a speech course, which was Introduction to Broadcasting, which I took.
Right.
And I met, you know, the teachers were three guys who were connected with local radio stations. And I actually ended up doing a couple of voiceovers for commercials while I was in the course. And then... I transferred to a state school up in Geneseo where they had, as I was majoring in special ed, I wanted to be a special ed teacher. So but I was also looking for a college that also had broadcasting as a minor so I could take some broadcasting courses.
Right.
And I ended up doing my first show on a professional station in the fall of 1969. And it was WGSU in Geneseo. And it was an FM station that had a radius that went into Rochester, New York, and I did three shows a week, and I worked with my best friend up at school, who they produced a kind of a radio comedy show. It was like the radio version of Laughing on TV, but it was a radio and he wrote bits, and we did bits, and we did things, and it was a very, very popular show on the station and in the Rochester area. He went on to write some shows for WKRP in Cincinnati, the TV show, DJ'd in Cincinnati at WSAI, and then out in California. He now lives out in California. But so that's how I got started. Then when I came back home and started to teach, I got a part-time job at one of the local radio stations back in 1971. And, you know, I worked for several local radio stations through the years, and I ended up back where at Gary's station. I had been there for several years working on the AM, actually doing afternoon drive after my shift at school.
Right.
That was when I was a marketing consultant for over 20 years. That's how Rick and I became close friends and radio partners when I was handling marketing as one of their gurus for over 20 years.
Right.
The Solid Gold Jukebox, actually, the concept started way back in the 70s.
I wanted to ask you that. Of course, just let me say formally that these two guys, and also the fact that you complement each other so well, on the radio, because you both have different styles. The Solid Gold Jukebox was a mainstay in the Hudson Valley and emanating from Poughkeepsie for so many years. I want to know how that actually started.
Well, I think, as I say, that I was working at another local station, an AM station, in 1973, and one of my weekend shifts was Saturday night. And even in college, when I worked on the college radio station, while other guys were playing more of the heavy metal, the late 60s rock and roll stuff, I was going back during my show and playing, doo-wop and, early 60s stuff. So in 1973, I started a show called the Saturday Night Oldies Show, which morphed into the Saturday Night Jukebox, which became the Solid Gold Jukebox. And then in the early 90s, I ended back up on the station where Gary was, and then we moved it to Friday night.
Uh-huh.
And I, the general manager was a friend of mine. He said, "We wanted you to come over. We acquired the oldies station. We want you to come back over." I was working for another station at the time. He said, "We want you to come back over, and we want you to do the jukebox on our station." He said, "You can pick whenever you want to do it." And I thought, well, Saturday night is a night when people, most stations have their oldies show, but I had the idea that a Friday night would be better because it would be when people were leaving work and starting the weekend, and I just figured it was a good way to get the weekend started instead of a middle of the weekend kind of thing, the beginning of the weekend thing. And so I started at 6, went to midnight every Friday night, and we'd get calls from people from all over, and I remember getting calls from truckers who would be coming up the thruway or coming across I-84, and they would tell me they timed their trip so they'd be going through the Hudson Valley when the show was on.
Well, six
actually, one night, yeah. Richard Nader called Rick and I.
Ah.
He was on the way to his summer home, and he said, "Hi, this is Richard Nader. Is this Rick and Gary Lee?" I said, "Wow." And he said, "Would you play something for me?" And Rick and I, our eyes were popping out of our head. And we played something for him, and that's something, a memory that I never forgot. Like, I never forgot that Rick's first song that he went out to buy was Sherry by the Four Seasons.
Wow.
Yeah, I did that when I was in my paper route. That was the first song, 45 I ever bought with my own money.
Wow.
I used to steal my sister's 45s, but
wow.
The first one I ever bought with my own money.
Mine was Jenny Lee by Jan and Arnie.
Oh, that was great. That was great, before Jan and Dean.
Right.
My first time behind the mic wasn't in 66 at BAB. I'm recalling nostalgia as we speak. It was on Murray the K's show when I was 17 in 1963. Now everyone knows my age, Rick.
Wow.
In 1963, Murray let me do an hour with him in the studio. And after my hour, he says, "All right, about now, Murray the K here, and Gary Lee's going to take my job away from me."
Wow, that's pretty cool. Now, too bad you don't have that on tape somewhere.
I don't.
Yeah.
Except now I do, during the Mike Miller show.
Yeah. Doing your own impersonation.
Right about now, right about here, on the soiree.
Yeah.
We all just loved Murray. The same way people used to look forward to listening to Don K. Reed on Sundays, more so people used to listen to Murray. I mean, I couldn't wait. I was in my own little world when I listened to Murray, and he created that world. I can remember just listening. I was a kid listening under the covers and just being in heaven and listening to really great tunes.
Yeah, I heard a story about you one time in one of your teenage pickups where you picked up one of your girlfriends.
Right.
When it got real intimate, you whispered in her ear, "Arabe, Arabe." Now, is that true?
That is true. But some of the best rumors about me, I started myself.
I know.
When they come back to you, you know, then you know you've hit the mark, you know.
The thing about this music, Mike, and it's always, for me, it's always been about the music. It's never been about me or, you know, the show itself. It's always been about the music. For me, it's always been being able to play the music that people love and to try to keep those memories that people have of the specific songs alive and stuff. And toward the end of my teaching career, I was teaching at a high school.
Right.
Coordinator of special ed for the high school, I went to my building principal and I said, you know, the state has changed requirements and now they're requiring kids to have a unit of art or music to graduate, and a lot of our special ed kids don't play an instrument and really aren't artistically inclined, so I have an idea for a course that would offer them this unit of music credit.
Wow.
For graduation. And he said, well, what is it? I said, well, I'd like to teach a course on history of rock and roll.
Wow.
And he said, well, come up with a syllabus and we'll talk about it. So I wrote a syllabus and and for the last 6-7 years that I taught, I also offered a course called History of Rock and Roll. And I used to tell my students that the music, I would start the first day of class and I would say, what's your favorite group? Or what's your favorite type of music? And I get people all saying, you know, whether it is punk rock or, you know, hip hop or whatever it was. And I said, well, I'm going to play a song for you. And I would put on something, some really rhythm and blues song, maybe Rocket 88 by Jackie Bresden or, you know, with the Ike Turner band and put on something like that. And I said, everything that you listen to goes back to this.
Right.
And music, you know, is connected and every little memory that people have growing up is connected to some kind of music that they were listening to or going on in their life. And that was the whole show for me. It was always about the music.
I agree with you there. You know, had I known you then, you know, when I was a dean in the Bronx, Jimmy Keys from the Chords had two kids in my school, you know, Jimmy Jr. and Paul, and they were not such great kids. So Jimmy was in my office a lot. And I would have brought him up there had we known that. He could have given the whole speech about how the black groups died on the R&B labels and the white groups mm-hmm. covered the groups. They covered the tunes and they never made their money. He died pretty much penniless.
Of course, and so many of them did. So many of the artists that passed away recently, it's kind of sad, from Speedo to J Train and my very, very, very close friend since 1964. I remember, Michael, when the jocks were as important as the recording artists and the stars. It's a funny feeling, and Rick and I talk about this frequently. Growing up on my transistor in my room in Yonkers, listening on KBW in Buffalo to Joey Reynolds, and then ending up doing co-hosting with him for a number of years, bringing on Lloyd Price and Arlene Smith, Kenny Vance, and Herb Cox, etc. It's a funny thing working with the people that you idolized when you were just a pre-teenager.
Right. No, I agree with you. And let's not leave out Tommy Shannon from KBW.
Oh, definitely, who had that great instrumental tune that is probably one of the 20,000 tunes that Rick has in his unbelievable collection.
Wild Weekend.
You know, one of the things that I remember about, you know, when I first learned to drive, and they got my license, and we would go out with buddies or whatever, is turning on KBW late at night, because 50,000 watt signal,
right.
Yeah, it was different. There weren't so many satellites up there, and you could actually get the signal pretty loud and clear. And listening to those great shows and those great jocks on KBW, Danny Nevereth, and they had an afternoon guy by the name of, he called himself Sandy Beach.
Was great jock.
And then, of course, I went to college up near there, and I spoke about my friend who wrote for WKRP in Cincinnati. He ended up, actually, while he was in college, doing overnights on weekends at KBW. That was his first professional radio job.
Wow.
And so I have fond memories of WKBW in Buffalo, even though I grew up in the Hudson Valley.
Absolutely. Now, Rick, you mentioned Jay Traynor, and of course, you know, I knew Jay when I was 17, and he actually wrote a song called Looking Out My Window, which I reminded him on your show, and he remembered the tune. He sent me the demo, and I think I have plans of maybe recording that for real just as a tribute to Jay. But why don't you tell me about your relationship with Jay Traynor, because I know She Cried was the tune that actually put Jay and the Americans on the map.
Right. Jay Traynor was the original Jay. I actually met Jay through Gary because we were doing a show together, and I said, you know, I would really love to meet Jay and have him on the show. So he was on several times with us. I think the first time he was on, it was his birthday, wasn't it, Gary?
The first time I brought him on was when you were on WKIP doing Saturday mornings. I brought him into the studio.
True, yeah. I was doing the Solid Gold Jukebox on Saturday mornings on another studio. Yeah, right. You're right. And, you know, Jay was such a great guy and so personable, and, you know, he would have such great stories and about growing up in the business or whatever, and he recorded early for the Jay and the Americans, and then, you know, unfortunate decision, he left the group, but those early songs like She Cried, Dawning, which was another great song.
Tonight from West Side Story.
Yeah, and he had originally also done some work with the Mystics.
Right. Well, you know, the story behind that, and you know that I do know that because I sang with them for a while. And the point is that the story about, you know, how he came into the Mystics and then left the Mystics, you know, it's all very mysterious. Everybody tells it a different way. And it was supposed to be that he was going through Jimmy Gribble's draw and got caught and whatever. That really wasn't it. I think, you know, Phil Krakalisi wasn't with the group for a while. And they were all waiting for Phil to rejoin the group. And anybody who filled those shoes, the family just said, you know, we're going to wait for Phil. So having done a couple of sides for the Mystics, I think it was George Galfo, believe it or not, who introduced Jay Traynor to the rest of the Americans. And he became the lead, as you know. And I was on the show with Jay Traynor one night on the Solid Gold Jukebox. And I remember Jay telling the story about how Jay Black told him, I will never catch you presenting yourself as Jay from the Americans, otherwise you will limp. And when that was a nice version of what Jay actually said. And then when I interviewed Jay Black went on to say that Jay Traynor was one of his best friends. I don't think so.
Will I see looking out my window, looking out my window, looking for my love? What will I see looking at the blue skies? Maybe it's her blue eyes looking back at me. Oh, when she left.
Hi, this is Jay Traynor, formerly of Jay and the Americans, and now with Jay Siegel's Tokens. You're listening to my good friend Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show.
Yeah.
Actually, Rick and I were at the Hard Rock Cafe in New York City a while back ago. I got the station to give me the limo. A lousy ride, also, by the way, too rocky. Rick and I were nauseous by the time we got down there. Nice limo people, but the road was so rocky by the time Rick and I got out of the car, we were hoping that we weren't going to get sick. So we walk in, CBS FM is there,
right.
Jerry Blavitt's there, everyone trying to figure out who the heck we are. And Jay Traynor was down there with us, and I went over and I introduced him to Jay Black, and Jay Black went, blah, 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 and that was it.
Wow.
Yeah, but I remember what that was for. That was the Dick Clark Rock and Roll Foundation or something?
Right,
It was a party it was a fundraiser or something for Dick Clark's Rock and Roll Foundation.
Wow.
And they had all kinds of stars performing that night at the Hard Rock, and you know, we were there. We were drove up in a limo. That was pretty special night.
And when I talk-
You know, it's really interesting. You know, Rick and I tried to do a station promo with one of the persons from Johnny and Joe. What was that, like 42 takes? And we finally said, to hell with it.
Yeah, we just couldn't get them to do the call letters correctly.
Yeah, yeah. When I'm in the Hudson Valley region, I listen to Rick and Sammy Lee on Okay, thanks a lot. Take care. It was nice meeting you. And then, you know, then back to the rocky road, back to Dutchess and Ulster County with the...
I think that's a, you know, always. I always think that's a bad idea because I never really liked those promos. I always think you put people in a bad spot. But
yeah, well, you know, I do them for my show, you know, because people get a kick out of them. And as a matter of fact, Joe McCoy did tell me personally that he wasn't crazy about all of Don K. Reed's promos, although people used to really look forward to the jingles, believe it or not.
Yeah, and I hear you.
I want to thank both of you publicly for taking Harmony Street and giving them a radio platform as we were starting to peak. And, of course, you know that we were on the show many more times than we deserve to be at key moments on the Solid Gold Jukebox, where you not only featured us and let us sing live, but also at key moments such as when you had Darlene Love on, such as when you had Kenny Vance on. And I remember doing a duet with Kenny. And I told Kenny about this years later, and I said to him, do you remember we did a duet on Gary Lee and Rick's show? And he said, yes, I do. What Kenny didn't remember was the fact that he wanted to do You Are Mine and We Belong Together. And he dragged me into one of the other studios for about an hour and 15 minutes to rehearse it. That song is a no-brainer. I played the guitar on it, but he still needed to rehearse for over an hour so that we got every inflection right. I don't know if you remember that.
Hey, you're a perfectionist.
Sit back and listen to the Solid Gold Jukebox.
Al, send in the first line.
Oldies 97.7.
They got lost, but they're here. They're eating the Caputo pizza. They're dropping the pizza on the floor.
They got lost because you gave them directions. That's right,
Dr. McCaffrey. I know that.
You're the man that told me you never give directions.
No, I said I was going to say erections, but I wouldn't say that on the air. Okay. We're here from Danbury, Connecticut. The moldy oldies from the sacred rat. These girls are gorgeous. And they love the lady. Well, I don't know if they love the lady. They like the lady. Trying to get them on the air now for over a year. I got to tell you the original story on this, everybody, in a second. This is great.
This is fun.
This is wonderful. Say something. We am tired.
Tired of talking?
Yes.
That'll never happen.
That's a first.
That will never happen. Never. Yeah, it's good to be anywhere tonight, but especially here on the radio. We've got a treat in store for all the listeners out there. We've got Harmony Street here.
You know, I've been calling Mike Miller, the dean of doo-wop, let me put his mic on. It's on. Okay, I've been calling Mike Miller now for about a year and 2 months, and he'd say, you know, Gary Lee, heard a lot about you and Dr. McCaffrey. Love to come on the Solid Gold Jukebox Friday night doo-wop, all these 97.7, 97.3.
We got a great Kenny Vance story.
And you remember the Laverne Baker? You were there for Laverne Baker, weren't you?
Yes, I was there when Chuck Rubin and Mary Wilson were there for the Truth and Rock Act as well. So I was there quite a bit.
Yeah, we had a great time. But I got to say here that Harmony Street was probably the greatest a cappella group we ever had live in the studio. You guys with the three girls.
Right.
Just the sound, fabulous. Just fabulous.
Well, actually, I have to agree with Rick 102%. Harmony Street, it was a pleasure. You always talk about learning from Rick and Gary Lee. We learned a lot from you and the girls, and it was always a pleasure and always something to be excited about when Rick and I would say, hey, this Friday night it's going to be Michael Miller and the girls, Ellen, and, you know, Ellen is doing well, and Dee and Robin are doing well, and Mike Miller, of course, is doing well. I mean, we're doing his show now, so, you know, as I referred to you in an article I wrote recently, the multi-talented Michael Miller.
The only one we left out is Scott. How's Scott doing?
Yeah, Scott's doing great. As a matter of fact, you know, Robin and Dee and Scott are still working as In Harmony. You know, I'm so glad that they kept the group going. They actually they took Lenny Cedar as their lead, who was my suggestion, actually. He moved up to Danbury, and I knew Lenny when he was a kid, and he's got a great voice, you know. And I'm glad that they kept the flame alive, because when we started that group, I put an ad in the newspaper, had tons of people march through, but then the three girls came over as a unit, and those are three girls with perfect pitch. And if you're a vocalist, a male vocalist, it's like you died and went to heaven, because, you know, you had three girls that sang like angels. The only thing is, Dee used to say on stage, "We have three times of the month, and we take it all out on Michael."
Yeah.
So.
A quick story about you guys were performing at Barbary's one night.
Jim Barbary's, right?
And we went with some friends. We were there, and in the middle of one of the sets, you did a song that I had totally forgotten about. It was a song by the Blossoms. I mean, I know you know what song.
Write me a letter.
Yep, and I had heard that song and loved that song the first time I heard it. But it had been years since I heard the song, and I kind of forgotten about it. And in the middle of one of the sets, the girls started singing that song, and I went, "Oh my God!"
Right.
Write me a letter. Wah, wah. Send me a line.
Blossom's recording, and right. That was just one of those times when you find this memory of a song in the back of your head, and it gets jogged loose, you know, and you went, "Oh man, I remember that."
Well, one of Darlene Love's best efforts, and you know, the girls were so talented that they could take on the Chantels and they could take on certain tunes. Like, we had a rendition of "Come Back to Me," Margot Sylvia's last effort. And that made it onto Collectibles Records. It also made it onto Kretschmar's Starlight. We were the only group ever to be recorded on Starlight Records that were tunes with music. We did the only two tunes with music on Starlight that ever got recorded for Kretschmar, and I thought that
was
interesting.
Everything else was a cappella.
Right.
Well, that's great.
Also one of the only groups to perform for the president at the White House.
That's true. We did, that was a long story as to how we got there. Probably too long for right now. Gary, let's talk about a little segment that you used to have on the show called Garyoke, which everybody looked forward to.
Except Herb Cox. Herb Cox called me a couple of weeks ago. We were talking on the phone. He lives in Atlanta, Georgia, formerly in Long Island. Herb was responsible for basically setting up with Rick and I Laverne Baker, who did a six-hour show with us that night. And when she passed away, Rick and I actually were very affected by her death because we had a strong six-hour relationship that ended in a very good friendship.
Wow.
You remember Garyoke, Mike? It was, I do. He had four or five, what did you say, six tunes that he recycled through.
Right.
How I'd like to look into that little book, the one that has the lock and key. Shut up, Gary Lee. Let's go on with the music. Okay, Rick.
Well, Garyoke, you used to sing some segments of a tune, and when we were there, we would back you up on it. And the first caller would get, dinner with Dee and Robin or whatever it was.
This is an opportunity. You know, I always try to give the groups that we have, Rick and Gary Lee, on the Solid Gold Jukebox Friday Night Do Up,
an opportunity
that'll stay with you for a long, long time. And that's one of these moments. What we're going to do now.
Guaranteed you'll be waking up tonight in a nightmare.
I know what you're going to do. You're going to take a song that they sing every week and make them sing it in another key.
That's very good.
That's very good, Mike.
He's got a three-song repertoire.
No, it's up to five now.
So the audience ought to know, in rotation, what the song is before you.
It's up to five now, and it's in heavy rotation. Okay, what we're going to do is I want to know the name of the song, the name of the artist, listeners. Guys and gals, I want you to call 454-9770.
You don't want the record company or the limo driver this time?
No, I'm not
going to
do that tonight. No. Or, you're not going to do that. Just 454-9770, 454-9770.
What do they win?
The name of the singer, the name of the artist. I'm going to give away a couple tickets to the Coaster concert. And actually, Carl Gardner's going to be there. This is not a bootleg group. This is a real Coaster group with Carl Gardner. And it's going to be Friday, July 3rd. It's going to be at Monticello Raceway. And you'll hear Yakety Yak, Charlie Brown, Poison Ivy, and a lot of great tunes. And this is for the 11 o'clock show at Monticello Raceway,
454-9770.
Of the night I held you, held you so tight, 'cause I love you so. Promise me, darling, you'll never let go. Beautiful. Boy, was I great on that.
Now you are.
Thank you. I'm steaming.
For those of you at home, that's number five on your Garyoke sheet at home. We had a winner.
Yeah, we had
Garyoke, right?
Yeah, Pete Sassano from Wappinger Falls. Bright guy. He said, Gary Lee, you made those guys sound really good, Harmony Street. And it was Instill the Night by Fred Parris and the Five Sands. So let's hear it for Pete.
That's right.
Hey, Pete.
I'm going to send him those tickets. Carl Gardner from the original Coasters, Monticello Raceway, next Saturday night, 11 p.m. show. And it's nice to see an original coaster on the road for a change. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
That's great.
You're not kidding.
And in fact, we once had a great evening. Johnny Maestro on the Brooklyn Bridge did an appearance at, they were at Poughkeepsie High School, and they came over afterwards to see Rick and Gary Lee. And of course, Les Couchy and the guys, they were phenomenal. Johnny Maestro did Sweetest One. And
My Juanita
and Rick and I had tears coming out of our eyes from how brilliant it was and how great it was. And Les Couchy said, Gary, do me a favor. Let's cut the karaoke tonight. Let's just stick with the two songs.
Yeah. You remember, I was just listening to that interview before we started this interview. You may remember this, that the only thing Johnny wanted was coffee, and we didn't have any coffee in the studio. Remember that?
Yeah, I remember
He was trying to get coffee all night. I guess they didn't have any coffee before the show or whatever. He's been looking for coffee, and we didn't have any
coffee. He didn't care about the computer pizza.
No, that's right. Yeah, that's right. But Gary put him on the spot and asked him if they would do a cappella version in the studio of Sweetest One and Juanita, and they did, and they just nailed it. I mean, you know, they did put out that a cappella CD. Which they just perfect.
Well,
perfect.
I know, and I've referred to this a couple of times, the famous moment when Gary said to Johnny Maestro, who do you think is better looking, Alice Cooper or Tony Bennett? And Johnny, I think, pushed the microphone away, and you said, Johnny Maestro has just been taken away for an emergency charisma bypass. Is that a true story?
Yes. Yes, it is a true story, but a better story than that is when I had Darlene, who finally endorsed the Darlene Love Radio interview on YouTube about 8 months ago. We got a couple thousand hits on it. That's pretty cool.
Right.
Rick and I did a marvelous job, if I must say so. And I said to Darlene after we were being very serious with her and talking about her new book that was out and how proud we are that you know, she's doing so well, I said, Darlene, who do you think is better looking, Gary Lee Schwartz or Mel Gibson? Just call me Stevie Wonder.
That's
and it was like it was like in a split second she thought of that, just like that. It was just so funny.
Well,
everybody
you know,
in the studio died. It was funny.
What's really funny is I was there that night. As a matter of fact, I did use that segment of the show and your introduction of her when I interviewed her last year, and she remembered vividly being there that night and said say hello to you both. As a matter of fact, now we know that she has risen to great heights and that she's now in the Rock Hall. And
do we ever get paid for that bit that you use? I don't remember ever getting a
check
from you.
No, you never did, but I'd just like to say put it on my tab.
All right.
All kidding aside, that was when the book now has been re-released in paperback, I guess, and was when it came out in hardback. That's a great book.
Right.
People haven't read that book. They should read that book. That is really a terrific story. And, of course, parts of that story were told in the Academy Award-winning documentary last year, 20 Feet from Stardom.
Did you see that, Michael?
I did.
Great.
It was terrific. And, you know, the power of that book, I found it to be a very spiritual book and, you know, very uplifting. And
I did.
It did have some sad parts in it, but...
But she never backed me on karaoke. That is true, right, Rick?
That's right, and it was a tremendous career decision she made. Too.
That's right.
I
agree with Dr. McCaffrey.
You're not going to get her now unless Paul Schaefer agrees to let her go, so there you go.
Yeah.
That's the way it is.
But we had some great interviews over the years, and, you know, the Laverne Baker interview was especially one of my favorites, because it was, you know, not too long after that she did pass away, and we got to pay tribute to one of the great
R&B artists.
You know, and you know, when you think about when they talk about people who influenced rock and roll or whatever, you know, they talk about Fats Domino and, you know, Chuck Berry and Little Richard and some of these other artists, but in the early 50s, Laverne Baker was doing it, you know, with the R&B stuff that was certainly influencing a lot of future girl group singers.
Right.
And it was so nice to be able to pay tribute to her. And what a sweetheart.
She was really an incredible woman. And I remember when Jerry Wexler called in, and that was really something exciting for the listener, Laverne, Rick and I. It was just incredible. One of the things that Rick and I are very proud of being part of is the 40th exclusive worldwide celebration of all the original members of J&E Americans talking about the anniversary on United Artists Records
right.
of She Cried. We had Jay Traynor, Kenny Vance, Howie, Sandy, and the listeners were going, they couldn't believe that we, on a medium-sized station,
right.
that we were able to obtain such a wonderful evening for the listener.
Hi, this is Kenny Vance.
This is Howie Kane.
Marty Sanders.
And I'm Sandy from Jay and the Americans.
And you're listening to Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show.
We, that was 2002, and we thank Kenny for that, kind of arranging to get the other guys there. I mean, Jay was going to be there, and Kenny was going to be there, but Kenny kind of arranged for Sandy and Howie to be there.
Wow.
And it was the first time in, I think, those 40 years that they had all been together, and it was the 40th year of She Cried.
Wow.
And we got them together. We took some photographs. As a matter of fact, Kenny sent me a kind of like a poster, and there's a photograph, I think, of the picture. I don't know whether it was a cover photo of the She Cried album where they have their hands in the air, all four of them. And then we took a similar picture with them in the same positions 40 years later with their hands in the air. And he had put the old picture on the top of the poster and the bottom, and the new picture on the bottom of the poster. And I
wow.
still have that. It was a terrific, terrific night. It was really a very special night.
That's funny. And had that happened after the hurricane, he wouldn't have had that picture because
I know,
he lost everything. He lost everything.
I was going to mention, not only did he lose his million-dollar house, he also lost his memorabilia. The last couple of years haven't been too good for the very talented Kenny Vance
right.
because of his not performing for about a year or so now. He has some physical problems. Rick and I, wish him a full recovery, and we were mourning Hurricane Sandy losing his valuables and his house, and Kenny, a very talented and very versatile artist.
I do know that, and of course, we all hope that Kenny comes back. We're all very, very plugged into Kenny. I wanted to ask Rick this. Rick, you sent me a long list of some of your favorite tunes, and of course, some of these tunes are not mainstream tunes. I looked down the list. Of course, Gee How I Wish You Were Here, Curtis Lee is a flip side, and that's a great tune. One that interested me was the Van McCoy tune, Mr. DJ, which is a doo-wop-y thing. Van McCoy was so talented. That was a fabulous tune. It was the first time I heard it, and it was not what I expected because it was very, very R&B doo-wop-y.
I've written down the information, so please, Mr. DJ, read my dedication. Dedicate a record over the air to somebody special who doesn't know I care, Mr. DJ. Make this dedication for me. Please play something special, something sweet and slow. Maybe she'll be listening to your show. Then Mr. DJ, if she hears it, then maybe she'll know. So if it's not asking too much, please won't you read my request? Then maybe my dedication will say the words I'm too shy to confess. So, Mr. DJ, I'm depending on you. This dedication could make my dreams come true. So, Mr. DJ, make this dedication for me.
Yeah, well, he recorded with a group in the 50s. They called themselves the Starlighters.
Right.
And there's a song called It's 12 O'Clock.
It's 12 o'clock. The party is over. Time to say good night, sleep tight. It's 12 o'clock.
Which he wrote, of course, and recorded with them. And there was another song, too, which slips my memory now. These are not necessarily, the list that I sent you are not necessarily my favorite songs.
Right.
I called it doo-wop treasures.
Right.
And all the years that I was doing the show, I was always on the hunt for, because, you know, when you get into the history of doo-wop, there were, in the tens of thousands of groups that sang on street corners and recorded demos and recorded one song or things that you never heard.
Right.
So I was always on the hunt whenever I'd go to a record store or everything, trying to find doo-wop songs that I had never heard before. These are just some of the songs that I discovered during this hunt. You know, I would come across a collection of, you know, a CD which would have a collection of songs on it, and as I would listen to it, this song would all stand out, and I would say to myself, wow, how come I never heard this record?
Wow.
How come this wasn't a hit? And one of the songs on that list is by the Chanters, which is a group out of Queens, and they had a lead guy. His name was Larry Pendergrass, and around 1957 or so they formed, and they're really unknown. It's an unknown group because they were so young that their parents, refused to let them, you know, do shows. They couldn't do any stage shows. They couldn't tour. But they did record, I think they recorded four or five, maybe a few more songs. And this song is Angel Darling, which was the flip side of a song they had, which was an up-tempo. You know, back then, one side was up-tempo, the other side was a ballad.
Right.
Turn it, don't burn it.
Yeah, so the up-tempo song was No, 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 but I had never heard, and I had heard No, 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 but I had never heard Angel Darling until I got this CD, and when I heard it, I said, wow, where was this song? Why wasn't this a hit? And when I went into the history a little bit of the group, I understood that they were relatively unknown because they were so young, and the parents weren't allowing them to go out and perform.
I'm writing you this letter. I've loved you from the start. I'm searching for the answer to heal my broken heart. Angel darling. Right. Angels surrender to me.
Michael, did you know that Rick really wrote The Hustle and it wasn't Van McCoy?
I also included a song here by the Four Buddies on Imperial Records. It was from around 1963, but it right. had been recorded by the Starlighters with Van McCoy. He wrote the song.
Right.
And then, so I included that song as well. Drive home in the car, I put the CD on. When the song came on, I went, whoa.
No, you know, Michael, when I walked in, there's 20,000 45s on the floor that I have to jump over before I got to the phone in the area that I'm speaking with you. Rick has 45 CDs, 8 tracks, all over the house.
Right. Not,
it's unbelievable.
I do know that. As you know, Speedo was a very good friend of mine, and I actually spoke to him in the hospital while he was in the nursing home. And believe it or not, Princess, his daughter-in-law, called me and said, I was at the show in Boca, which was his last show, and I had this camera that has a real wide-angle lens, and I took some real great close-ups of him on stage. And she said to me, would you mind if we used one of the pictures that you sent us as the picture in front of his coffin? And I really got tears in my eyes. And she said, you know, we want you and Paulette to fly up for the funeral, and we couldn't and everything. But, you know, I was very close to him, and most people don't realize they remember the Cadillacs as the up-tempo stuff, but the guy probably was one of the best ballad singers ever. And Your Heart Is So Blind is one of those, great Earl Carroll ballads, because nobody sang a ballad like he did.
Stop your running,
all around with all the fellows that's in a town. Can't you see your mind? Your heart is so blind. So blind. Friends are saying that I'm a fool, but I just laugh and play it cool. Can't you see your mind? Your heart is so blind. No matter what our friends say, your love is a here to stay. I know how, that's how I feel. My love is true and oh so real. I'll just wait patiently until your heart considers me. Can't you see your mind? Your heart is so blind, so blind. Your heart is so blind.
Everything going?
I'm doing great.
Hi, this is Earl Speedo Carroll of the Cadillacs, and you're listening to my good friend Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show.
And that was another song that I included on that list as a treasure, because when I first heard that song, it really was a treasure, and I went, oh, whoa. Because you listen to Gloria, you know, some of the ballads, and
right.
this song, for some reason, the recording of this song is so crystal clear, and his voice just, it was a record that they never released. In 1959, record company never released the song, and it wasn't until years later, in the 90s, late 90s probably, that when they were starting to put out these compilations on CD, they would include some of these unreleased tunes, and that's how I discovered it. And it's, I think, one of the best ballads he ever did.
Absolutely.
You know, Michael, it's kind of upsetting. Rick and I have spoken about this on the air and off the mic about guys like Speedo and Earl Lewis from the Channels that had to have day jobs with the great, great songs they recorded, and the public loved their appearances and the music they put out because of the industry being kind of crazy with the payola and a lot of people not receiving their royalties. It was kind of sad how many people who had talent never made it and had to have day jobs to supplement their income when they should have been full-time in show business and the music industry.
Absolutely. Times are different now, and we see that throughout the history of this music. Gary, you sent me a list of songs, too, and one of them is Over the Rainbow, Lenny Dell and the Dimensions. Lenny used to sing at the Garden City Hotel and play piano, and I used to go there for a drink once in a while. One night, a guy walks in. Lenny does Over the Rainbow with just him and the piano, and the guy walks over to him, and he says, "You sound just like the guy that sang that from the Dimensions. I can't believe it." And Lenny's answer was, "Thank you." And I went over to the guy afterwards and I said, "You know who that is? That's Lenny Dell from the Dimensions." And the guy flipped out. But Lenny's personality was such that he didn't even say, "I'm the guy, I'm the guy." He just said,
yeah.
He just said, "Thank you."
So
interesting. Over the Rainbow was recorded by hundreds of people, from Judy Garland to David Campanella and the Delcords, which is Roy Campanella's son.
Right.
I mean, Over the Rainbow is the kind of song you never get tired of it. Rick and I wouldn't play it every week because we had such a vast list of great golden oldies, as Rick and I would say, the moldy oldies from the sacred rack.
Right.
We had so many tunes to play for the vast audience that, you know, occasionally we'd do Over the Rainbow, but it was a great song. I mean, if you put it on now, I would probably get chills because of our love for the music and the love for just the industry.
Another great version, if you sometimes listen to it, is the one by Cornelius Harp with the Marcells.
Another song that you chose was the Diablo's version of The Wind, and you know, I wrote an arrangement to that. I don't know if I sent it to you guys, and I recorded it with the Mystics. It's it's an up-tempo version of The Wind, and we played it for the Diablos, and they freaked out. They loved it.
Love it.
used to shake his head when I would do the intro for The Wind. I would go, and here's a great record on the Solid Gold Jukebox with Rick McCaffrey and Gary Lee Schwartz, Cutting Wind by the Diablos.
There you go. Well, you know, that's a Gary thing.
Right. And Rick would say, do you have to go to the bathroom or anything,
no,
Gary? Anything
say,
you got to do?
Just say, not again, Gary.
Actually going to be emceeing a show in October, and Lenny Dell and the Dimensions will be there. They haven't been in Florida in quite a long time.
Well, neither has Rick.
Well, it's very funny that when I was with the Mystic Group at the Broward, I remember Rick called me and said, we're going to be in the audience that night. And that was a big Richard Nader show. And I don't remember, Rick, did I ever get to say hello on stage?
Yes, you did.
I think I did.
You know, talking about Johnny Maestro, Johnny Maestro has to be the greatest rock and roll doo-wop singer ever, or one of the top two or three. Johnny Maestro is not a performer. Johnny Maestro is like Johnny Mathis, a true artist and singer. Backstage, you see Johnny reading a book, and he wasn't snobby. He was a gentleman. He just didn't want to be bothered. Backstage, he was just relaxing and getting ready. A lot of people said, he's a snobby guy. He's not a performer. Johnny Maestro was an artist and a singer, just as I said, like Johnny Maestro and Tony Bennett. You know, Tony Bennett is a performer and an artist, but, you know, guys like Maestro and Johnny Mathis were basically singers. Their voice were like instruments. That's how good they were.
Johnny used the pace before he would go out there. Well, you remember the famous... We did Newtown High School, which, of course, was the same high school where they had the shootings at that time, and it was Harmony Street and Johnny Maestro and the Brooklyn Bridge.
We were there that night.
Yes, and actually, we did a couple of shows with them, and there was the one night that Ellen used to bake, of course, a whiskey cake or a cheesecake, and I remember Ellen baked a cheesecake, and she left it there, and Freddie and Les and Johnny had cheesecake all over their mouths when we came off the stage after doing an hour and 20 minutes, and I said to him, when you eat dairy before a show, you know, it's very mucus producing and you have trouble singing. I can't do it, you know. And he says, coats the throat. And then they went out there and they kind of crashed and burned. I remember them doing I Thank the Moon a cappella and they crashed on it. Johnny said, and I'll never forget this, he said, you know, back in the neighborhood, you always got one do-over. We're taking ours now. And I said to myself, you know, that's a true professional. You know, Johnny had a very dry sense of humor. I want to talk about the New Pulse show.
Yeah, well, that was, I was going to mention that because you were very instrumental in that for us getting that recorded. You may remember this,
yes.
That night. They were appearing at a club over in New Pulse, New York, just off the New York State Thruway.
Right.
And I know they were doing one show, and that show sold out, and so they added a second show.
I remember two shows.
And we approached Les Couchy and Johnny's management about the possibility of broadcasting the first show live over the radio station.
Which they never do.
And they agreed.
Right.
So, if you remember that night, we had our, you know, broadcast set up. Marty was set up. We were all ready to do the live broadcast. And you went over and talked to Smitty, their sound guy.
Right.
If we hooked our Marty right into the sound mix.
Right.
Which we did. And what we didn't know, Gary and I, what we didn't know was that our program director was back at the radio station and he was recording the concert. He was recording the show.
Wow.
And the quality of that recording is phenomenal.
You bet.
And so about a week later, you know, we come in next Friday night to the show, and in the mailbox there's a CD for each of us that had the live concert on it. And I think that's the only live, you know, audio. I know they've had a couple of videos,
right,
of them performing. I think it's the only live audio performance, and at that time, that was before the videos were put out, the only live audio recording of a Johnny Maestro on the Brooklyn Bridge show.
And Rick and I got a copy from Randy Turner to send to Johnny and Fred Ferrara and
right.
Les Couchy.
Right.
And the listeners loved it. And then I remember Rick and I had a pretty powerful intro on that. We were so psyched up. The intro was, you know, unbelievable. It was like, you know, we were one of the top jocks in the world. We were so psyched.
Right.
And the audience was psyched and the people home listening.
Well, that was the reason that we approached them about recording the concert was because the show sold out and there were a lot of people that were disappointed. He was getting a lot of calls back at the station. We're sorry the show's sold out. We so much wanted to be there. So we had this idea that maybe if we broadcast the show live, those folks who couldn't get tickets would be listening to the concert in their homes during the regular time that the Solid Gold Jukebox was on. So it was really incredible.
It was fun. And thanks again, Mike.
Well, yeah. No, thank you guys. Well, you know, I'm going to tell you something about that night that you guys might not remember. If you remember correctly, everybody was pacing because they were late. And I was standing out in the main road, and they really were a little bit late to set up all the equipment, do the sound check, whatever. And by the time they got there, it was a little bit of hustle and bustle getting out there and getting everything set up in time for the crowd. But they did. But they, if I remember that day, they were about an hour and a half late because they take a lot of time setting up because Johnny was a perfectionist, if you remember.
Wow. You know, Rick, I always thought through these years that Mike was in charge of valet parking. That's why he was outside.
Yeah.
Never mind. You know, when I was a young kid, It was in Roslyn, Long Island. There was a place called the Lake Tower Inn, and a friend of mine and myself used to park these cars, and put them like an inch away from each other. I remember those days of parking the cars. On your list, Gary, All in My Mind, Maxine Brown, a great tune.
One of the top 25 greatest ever R&B tunes. I talk about that with Rick so many times. He says, change the subject. That's all you talk about, like you're managing Maxine Brown. You know, he does one of his Rickle things on me, you know. Mm-hmm. But Maxine Brown, she had a couple of mediocre tunes after that, but All in My Mind was a great, great tune. She's been quiet the last couple of years. She's probably like your age, around 80, you know what I'm saying?
Like you don't care, and it's more than I can bear. I don't know, baby. Maybe it's all in my mind. All in my mind. I know that I've been true, but honestly, baby, what about you? I don't know, baby. Maybe it's all in my mind. We've been going steady so long. I never dreamed you would ever do me wrong. I knew I was yours, and I thought you were mine.
Version of that song, Willie Winfield.
Oh yeah,
was with the harp. Later in the '60s, the Harptones did an album and it had "Foolish Me" on it. I don't know if you remember.
Oh, that's a great song.
But they also on that album it had "Had All in My Mind." His version of that. What a great voice Willie Winfield.
You know, it was interesting because I interviewed Raul Cita, and Raul Cita is the type of guy when you interview him and you say to him, "Hey, Raul, you wrote so many great tunes, you know, and I just want to thank you." You know, because, you know, you were really the brain trust behind the Harptones. And to think of all the fabulous tunes, you know, that you wrote that Willie was able to, you know, like croon upon and whatever. And you'd say, thank you so much. How do you feel about that? And he'd go, yep.
Would you say that, I'm going to ask a question to Michael. The Diary by Neil Sedaka, great song, of course. You know, he sang with Jay Siegel and the Tokens right. In the early days from Lincoln High School. Would Neil Sedaka be one of the first artists to overdub his voice?
That's an interesting question. Because as you know, a lot of them overdubbed their own backgrounds. Billy Stewart did that on most of his tunes. And
you know who was one of the first artists to do that? Buddy Holly.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
Norman Petty, who was his producer, he got a new piece of equipment and they were able to overdub. And Buddy Holly was one of the first artists that ever experimented with that.
And you know who's responsible for the overdub, don't you? Les Paul.
You're right, Les Paul. Not only was he a legendary guitar player and inventor, But that's right, Les Paul, yep. And you remember his wife, Mary Ford, very talented singer.
Right.
Number six on my list was Pledging My Love, and Rick would cringe when I would... Actually, Rick would almost leave the room when I would play Pledging My Love by Johnny Ace, because it would go something like this. He took a gun to his head, and now he is dead. Here's the late and great Johnny Ace, everybody, Pledging My Love. He died playing Russian roulette.
Unbelievable.
So whenever I would do that...
Well, that was the story, but there were some shady circumstances around that, whether it was really Russian roulette or not. The story...
Could have been
really,
Jewish roulette.
The story is really not... The whole story has not been told.
Darling, your love in return. Make this fire in my soul, dear, forever burn. My heart's at your command, dear, to keep love and to hold. Making you happy is my desire, dear. Keeping you is my goal. I'll forever love you the rest of my days. I'll never part from you and your loving way. Keeping you is my goal. I'll forever love you the rest of my days. I'll never part from you and your loving way.
That's a great song.
Also, To the Isle, you know, most people remember the Five Satins for
Night.
And To the Isle is just a great tune, great lyrics, and very well sung.
First a boy and a girl meet each other. Then they sit down to talk. To the eye, you may start with a simple conversation, like, darling, please put me on trial. She says yes, and your heart starts beating, while each step draws you closer. You ask her if she loves you. She answers, I do. Your heart starts glowing inside, and then draws you closer to the eye. Then you put a ring on a finger. Then the step draws you closer, closer to the eye. She says yes, and your heart starts beating, while
each step
draws you closer,
closer
to the
eye. Hi, this is Rick McCaffrey of the Solid Gold Jukebox, and you're listening to my good friend Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show.
I know people that were near and dear to you, Gary. You know, Joey Reynolds was one, and of course, you know, you mentioned Dan Ingram, who I think was one of the best, but Jack Spector has been brought up by a lot of people as being one of the best in the biz.
Oh, he was terrific.
He was wonderful on CBS FM, WMCA, one of the good guys. And unfortunately, Rick and I were talking about this the other day, Jack Spector died on the air doing a radio show in Long Island.
Wow.
You ever notice it's all about death with Gary? For some reason, I don't know
where
the age we're at or whatever, but it just seems to just all. But what I remember about Jack Spector is when he was, I think he was on CBS FM later when he did his Saturday Night Sock Hop.
Great.
And ever a better jock than Jack Spector? He was just so laid back. So, I mean, he was just, you could sit and listen to him all night, listen to his banter all night. He was just terrific.
Ooh, I love that song. 1959, Johnny Mathis, the old Errol Garner song, and Misty at 101 FM. And I must admit, tonight I am a little misty. After 9.5 years, I mean, delightful years, joyous years here at CBS FM, I am leaving the station. It has been, as I said, a great time. And why am I leaving? Well, you know, it's a career move, kind of a decision I had to make. And I made it, and I'm not sorry I did. So again, thank you for putting up with me for 9.5 years. And be nice to the guys that stay behind. And you'll be hearing about me, and you look after yourself, okay? So one last time, your main man, Jake, takes leave of you with the number one song. Look out, Street, Here I Come.
My list had, like, Alan Freed, Murray the K. I met Jocko when I was 13 years old at the Apollo Theater, and it's funny because in later years I worked and I met Lloyd Price and I brought him to the Joey Reynolds show. But Jocko was one of the greatest radio personality entertainers ever. And when the show was over, I was like 12 and a half, 13, they walked me to the subway, Lloyd Price and Jocko, and they said they don't think that a white Jewish boy should be walking around Harlem alone. So they walked me and got me on the train to go back up to Riverdale. And then from there, my parents picked me up and, I went home to my house in Yonkers. But it was a real great experience meeting people like that. I once met B. Mitchell Reed on Park Avenue when I was a teenager, and I said, "Wow, you're B. Mitchell Reed." And he said to me, "So?"
the Jocko story, later in his life, he was involved with this organization that provided, I don't know whether it was tapes or things about kids staying in school.
Education.
Educational materials. And so we booked him, and we got a phone interview with him one night. And, of course, Gary and I, we wanted to reminisce about
Sam Cooke.
You know, about the old days,
yeah.
The shows that he did and all that stuff.
Right.
But all he wanted to talk about, he really didn't want to talk about any of that stuff. He only wanted to talk about this educational stuff,
wow,
which was great, and I give him a lot of credit for that. But we were a little frustrated during the interview because we wanted to talk about some of the memories he had with working with some of these greatest artists and some of the great shows he did and everything. And he was a true pioneer as far as
television. He was the first black performer, disc jockey personality that had his own television show in New York on Channel 13. I believe it was WNET at that time.
Right.
But Jocko, Rick knows I had to sneak in something. I went, "E diddly ock, this is the jock, back on the scene with the record machine. Correct time now, 10:15. So we broke them up. I got a chance to put one plug in there. But Rick and I thought we were going to talk about the Apollo Theater, how he discovered Sam Cooke, and we were going to talk. He was a very handsome man, and he only died at 70 years old, way before his time. As Rick would say, Gary's talking about death. No, I won't talk about Jim Morrison, I promise. I won't talk about Janis Joplin.
Wasn't Jaco the first one to say Sakatumi?
I think he was. I think he was the first rap artist also.
There you go.
Well, late 60s, it was Richard Nixon on Laughing.
I give my heart to you, hoping someday we'll be together. I feel this way. Someday we will fall in love.
That I've been on stage with a lot of the greats, and you guys have interviewed a lot of the greats, and I have, you know, in the last 6 years since I started the radio show, gotten to touch an awful lot of people, one of them being Johnny Mathis, Be Still My Heart. But
did you get arrested?
No, but isn't it funny how, but he did kiss me on the cheek and hug me and Paulette backstage, and
okay.
He was very soft and sweet, and I was trembling, you know. It's like when what's his name says I get a tingle up the leg. I got a tingle up the leg from Johnny Mathis, because you could hear a pin drop at the beginning of every song. I mean, you know, when he spoke and he started every song, everybody went,
chances are.
Absolutely.
Well, not quite like that, but.
Absolutely. But what I wanted to say to you guys is, isn't it funny how you still are in awe of some of these people that walked into your studio and were guests on your show, you know, and you said to yourself, pinch me, because I'm standing in front of either a Mary Wilson or a Darlene
right.
Love or mm-hmm. or any of those people who were in your living room from the time you were a kid, and all of a sudden you're standing there with them having a give and take conversation, you know, what
right.
could be better than that?
Well, I had a similar experience. It was in the mid-1970s, and one of the songs, you know, earlier I mentioned about having this paper route where, and more often than when I was on my paper route when I heard songs for the first time. And one of the songs that I remember hearing was Gypsy Cry by Lou Christie. In the mid-70s, I was doing the Saturday night show on this AM station here in Poughkeepsie. And it was in the fall, and the summer before that, I had gotten a call from a guy by the name of Tony Romeo. Now, Tony Romeo was a songwriter and a producer, produced the Partridge Family and
Brooklyn Bridge.
Right.
He had a home in Pleasant Valley, which is a town near Poughkeepsie, a little village near Poughkeepsie, and he was home. And I was doing my show, it was a Sunday afternoon, I was doing a show, and it was in the middle of summer, it was about 95 degrees, very humid, and he calls me up and he says, he introduces himself and he said, I'm trying to write a Christmas song and I can't get any inspiration. Is there any way you could play a couple of Christmas songs? So I go back in the library and I dig out, Let It Snow, Let It Snow, Let It Snow, and, you know, Winter Wonderland. I play like three or four songs in a row or whatever. And he was writing for the Partridge Family Christmas album, and the song he was writing, an original song, was called My Christmas Card to You, which he wrote in inspiration. So fast forward a few months, it's Saturday night, I'm doing the oldie show, he calls me, he says, I've got a house guest here this weekend, I wonder if we could come down and visit at the station. I said, sure. So, you know, about a half hour later, at the station door, I go to the door, and Tony comes in, and he's with him is Lou Christie.
Oh, great.
And the same, it was the same kind of feeling, because I had always been a Luke, ever since Gypsy Cried, I'd been a Lou Christie fan or whatever, and being able to meet Lou Christie and then interviewing him on the radio, it was really quite an experience.
What Rick did in the future when he needed a falsetto, he would rent Lou Christie's voice for a couple hours.
That's right.
One thing I wanted to mention about, you know, going gaga, one thing I learned through the years is you go gaga after the performer goes home. I'll give you a perfect example. Clay Cole once said to me on the phone, "What I like about you, Gary, is that you don't make a big deal about me. You don't do what a lot of the other jocks do. Oh, it's Clay Cole during the interview. You know, if you think I'm pretty cool, you may tell your wife and your friends afterwards I met Clay Cole. I remember when I was a kid growing up with him."
Hi, this is Clay Cole. You're on the Harmony Street Show with my good friend Mike Miller.
A lot of these guys do not like when you go gaga. If you do it privately, they don't know about it, but, you know, it's... I can understand their feelings. I want Rick to tell this great Kenny Vance story. I was going to do it, but I think Rick does it even better.
Absolutely.
We were several times Kenny would come up to the studio, and he would sit with us or whatever, and we would interview him. And, Kenny, he's such a great storyteller.
Right.
You know, when he would tell stories about different recording sessions and different artists and different songs or whatever. So we always look forward to having Kenny with us. One particular night, it was getting late, and Kenny was really tired. Friday night, he was getting really tired, and it was getting late in the evening, like 10:30 or something at night. And he said, "Well, you know, Rick, Gary Lee, I think I'll listen to the rest of the interview in the car." I look at Gary, and Gary looks at me. How are we going to do an interview if he's in the car driving back to New York?
And he was serious, Michael. You know, he wasn't kidding around.
It was pretty funny, though.
Yeah,
we could understand the fact that, you know, he was tired and he had a couple hour drive back to the city and all.
Right.
But it just struck us as very funny that he would say, "Oh, I'll listen to the rest of the interview in the car."
I once had a very strong friendship and professional relationship with Kenny Vance. We did a lot of professional things for each other. We kind of had a falling out a number of years ago, and, you know, but that doesn't mean that I don't pray for his recovery and his success, and, you know, I felt bad when he lost his home and his memorabilia,
right.
And I feel very bad about his illness, but I do miss communicating and hearing from Kenny. I remember the days before Looking for an Echo when he'd pick up the phone, 12:30 a.m. He must have thought it was a different time zone where he lived in Rockaway, and he'd call me, and it was a pleasure and an honor, and he played me the entire soundtrack of the movie Looking for an Echo.
Right.
Thank God the actor that did the lip syncing wasn't in my house doing it, because it was a good movie and a great soundtrack, but I thought what was wrong with that movie was the star, Armand Asante, did a very poor job lip-syncing it.
Well, Kenny mentioned that when we were on the radio together that time on Solid Gold Jukebox, and he said he even mentioned the fact that he wished that Armand Asante had done a better job lip-syncing.
Right, right.
If I remember correctly.
In fact, he was in the news yesterday that he actually is having financial problems at 64 years old. I think he's a great actor and a great-looking man. And as I said, I do miss the friendship and the relationship with Kenny. And I wish he would come back and be well for a long, long, long time, Michael. It's been really so much fun doing what we do. And what amazes me, you wake up one morning, if the years are great or the years are not always great, you find it amazing that all of a sudden you're over 60 years old. How the heck did that happen? My dogs are gone. My parents are gone.
Right.
Life is fantastic.
Right.
The economy's getting better.
Right.
You know, some of our investments are doing well. Some of them are not doing well.
Right.
But, you know, it goes so fast. Life is so precious.
It does.
And it's,
you must embrace, you must do one thing that you love to do every day and not forsake that. And you have these days, every day is much more precious than it was when we were younger. Let's talk about Little Isidore. If I remember correctly, we were in Chappaqua on the Green.
Oh my God.
And
that
I
was
think
scary.
It was Harmony Street and then Little Isidore and the Inquisitors. And you tell the story, Gary.
Well, actually, I'll let Rick tell the story. He was driving that night.
we were, you know, the show went well, and after the show was over, there was a little pizza place next to the park. It was an outdoor summer, one of those summer, free summer concerts, and so Gary and I stopped in for a slice of pizza. We're in the pizza place, and we hear all kinds of sirens and emergency vehicles going by and all the rest of that, and we get in the car and pick nothing of it. We're heading home. We're on 684. We're driving north, heading home, and we get a phone call from you, Mike, telling us that they had taken little Isidore. He was having chest pain.
He collapsed in my arms.
Yeah, and they took him to the hospital. And
I've spoken to him about that, too.
And recently. Did they do bypass surgery? Or just
they lost him. They lost him. In the hospital, like think twice and whatever. If you remember correctly, that night he was wearing a brown suit, and he used to like to wear the suit jacket with no shirt under it, just his bare chest. And he was, and we were talking, he was smoking a cigarette. He collapsed like right in front of me.
I pray for you, my dear. I'm thankful every day.
And he had his hair up and all that makeup. And I remember when he got well, I put him on a television show with me that Rick don't even want to know about. This was like with Gloria Gibson. I don't know if I ever showed you the tape on that. But Rick and his wife, Kathy, never laughed so much. Me interviewing little Isidore. And one of the things I mentioned to him was I could just imagine the doctor saying when they wheeled this guy in almost dead, who is this guy? You know, because he had the feminine makeup on, but he's a straight married guy with children, very talented songwriter, still out there right now with his new group, Little Isidore and the Inquisitors, which is a couple different members from his old group. Great talent. And I am so happy that he recovered. But I once said to Rick, I was a little disappointed when we bumped into him after a couple of years that he was smoking.
Right.
And I hope that today in 2014 that he's no longer smoking.
Well,
and, you know, your interview with Johnny Gale was a combination of incredible, shocking, and very well done.
Thank you. I mean, you know, I do really respect Johnny Gale for all that he's contributed to the business. As a matter of fact, I spoke to him the other day. Johnny has now been signed by Martin Scorsese to be his musical director for some new films that are coming up. So Johnny really has reached that pinnacle at this point where he is really being accepted by some of the heavyweights.
What an enormous talent. Really, really.
Very polite, very professional. You know, he would always be polite to Rick and I. I don't know if he remembered our names, but, you know, he remembered our faces, you know, when we saw him. Unbelievable talent. He was just incredible. I think he had a lot to do with the success as much as Kenny Vance. One thing I want to say, some people may agree with me. I don't even know if Rick agrees with me on this. I think Elvis Presley was the king of rock and roll basically because he was white. If there wasn't problems at the time, racial problems, maybe Chuck Berry or Fats Domino or other great black artists would have been called the king of rock and roll.
Well, I think because of the history that Elvis, people consider him or call him the king of rock and roll, but I think it was because of Elvis that these R&B artists were able to have their music played or get discovered. And I remember the story about Fats Domino at a concert one time. They introduced Pat Boone.
Great story.
Who was in the audience at of a Fats Domino concert, and everybody was booing Pat Boone because I, you know, Pat Boone did
the covers.
Ain't it a shame, you know? And Fats Domino says to the audience, "No, no, 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 no! Don't you be booing my friend Mr. Boone here or whatever, because you see, if it wasn't for Mr. Boone, you see all these rings on my fingers, I wouldn't have any of these rings on my fingers.
Right. That's great.
And that's basically, a lot of people, you know, the white artists covered these songs, and they were able to bring attention to the R&B. A lot of people would go, oh, I want to hear the original, and then they would listen to the original and say, this is pretty good, let me listen to some more songs by this guy, and the next thing you know, you know, a Little Richard or a Chuck Berry or a Fats Domino, their records were getting pretty popular.
It was interesting that Chuck Berry supposedly claims he wrote all these songs right before he passed away. His piano player claims that he never got his royalties for writing half of the songs with Chuck Berry. Huh. So I'm sure his estate is trying to get the money from Chuck Berry, but good luck. Chuck is 86 years old, not in good health. He grabs a band locally, pays them a couple bucks, and they back him. It's no longer, you know, a big Alan Freed orchestra, right, you know, and all that stuff. But
you remember the movie American Hot Wax?
Sure.
Mike?
Sure.
Well, the scene in that movie where, you know, they have to show Chuck the briefcase of money.
Produced by Kenny Vance, by the way.
That's right. Kenny Vance did that.
Right. They take away the briefcase of money. And we did a show here at the Mid-Hudson Civic Center one time, and Chuck Berry was the headliner on the show. And the radio station was kind of promoting the show or whatever. And basically, it's true.
I saw them put the money in the briefcase.
Yeah, he has a briefcase, and he has to be paid in cash, and he has to have the money before he goes on stage. You know, but that's as a result of being cheated out of money all those years, that they wanted to make sure that they had the money in hand before they actually went out on stage and did the concert. But
I was asked down here in Florida to join the Footlighters Club, which is an offshoot of the Friars Club up north. And what's interesting about this is that all of the old guard, most of the comedians that were Catskill guys and some of the old agents, are now part of the Footlighters Club, and they all get together for certain things. I was asked to do an interview for Benny King and be part of that situation when they roasted him down there. And what's funny is that one of the old agents cornered me and was telling me a story. I'm getting a little echo. I don't know why, but it was telling me a story about Fats Domino. He said, you know, he was one of the first people to book Fats Domino in Vegas. And he said he got him for a weekend, and it was one of the old guard casinos out in Las Vegas. He says he gets a phone call from the head of the casino, and the guy says, hey, you know, he says, how's Fats Domino doing? You know, is he drawing? Is he booking? He says, well, I'll tell you what. He says, we're going to sign him for another 3 years.
Huh.
And he says, but you need to fly your ass out here like very, very soon. And you got to be part of this. So he flies out there and they have a meeting in the office. And he says, the reason that we want to book him for another 3 years is not the fact that he's doing so great in the room. The reason is because he was run up $100,000 gambling debt. And we're not letting him go until he makes back the money. So he's going to be working for us for 3 years. And supposedly that's a true documented story. I think it's very interesting.
I remember during Hurricane Katrina, he was stuck on his roof.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, he's in pretty bad health right now.
Yeah, it's he's in his late 80s. Chuck's in his late 80s. As I said, you know, it was just a shame that Jay Traynor passed away at 71 years old. You know what I'm saying? But Rick and I talk about the pace of these guys. One night they're in Colorado, the next night they're in Philadelphia. I mean, even young guys touring, the travel, the buses, the planes, the cars. I mean, you know, you do some traveling out of your area. Right. It's really rough to handle it.
I saw Frankie Valli on the TV for the 4th of July celebration in Washington, D.C.
Right.
He sounded great.
He did. I will tell you there's a lot of controversy about that.
Right, about the lip syncing.
Yep, right. And I know people that are close to him, and I know people that have seen him recently in concert and whatever, and from what I understand, you know, of course, secondhand information is dangerous, but from what I understand, right, that it's very heavily auto-tune, you know, pitch correction, mm-hmm, and very heavily that his vocals are on a track, and he sings with the vocals, and he chooses to hit the notes that he wants, and some of the notes, and he, you know, he'll only sing two or three high falsettos, you know, in an evening, and that's about it. But then again, he's Frankie Valli, and he doesn't.
He's 79 years old.
He's 80.
I'm 80.
And he doesn't
80,
have to prove it.
I'm very disappointed that Jersey Boys in the movies is not doing as well as I expected. Rick will tell you an interesting story when he saw Jersey Boys on Broadway.
Right. It was a couple of months after the show opened, you know, with the original cast, John Lloyd Young, the original cast. And the radio station had given away, they had a contest where you could win tickets to see Jersey Boys.
Right.
And we'd go down on a limousine, and we would see the show. So this couple won, and they, my wife and I, and we went down in the limousine, and we get to the show or whatever. Everybody's excited, and the show is terrific. So toward the end of the show, I'm looking, because we're sitting toward the back, I'm looking over my right shoulder, and I see a figure, because the house is dark, and I see a figure kind of standing in the aisle against the wall, leaning against the wall, and then they go into the finale, and everybody's on their feet screaming and whatever, and the lights start to come up, and I look over my shoulder, and it's Bob Gaudio from the Four Seasons.
Uh-huh.
So everybody starts filing out. They're walking past him as they file out. Nobody knows who he is except me. So I strike up a conversation with him. We talk for a few minutes. I tell him, you know, what a fan I was of the Four Seasons. I even told him a story about Five Sherry, the first record I ever bought with my own money, blah, 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 and so on and so forth. And I asked him if he would sign my playbill, which he did. And he said he was there because, you know, they like to drop into a couple of shows to see if any part of the play needs to be tweaked or fine-tuned or whatever, so they try to drop in, get audience reaction in different parts of the show, and that's why
right.
I was there. But I just felt so, it was so funny that people had just sat through the entire show with him, with an actor playing him on stage, and nobody really knew who he was, and they just filed past him and just thought he was somebody connected
wow.
to the show or whatever. But it was, you know, we had a nice conversation, and as I say, he did sign my playbill, so I always...
I have a similar story that I'm going to give you just very, very quickly. And that is that I was in New York and we saw a couple of Broadway shows. So on the last day that we were there in the morning, it was actually on a Sunday, I went into the theater for Jersey Boys and I said, I'd like to have two tickets. And they said, where would you like them? I said, somewhere in the center, you know, close to the stage and whatever. And they said, what month would you like to have these tickets for? And I said, well, actually for tonight. And they started laughing. Mm. So I said, well, I sing with the Mystics. And, you know, it's like, so the guy says to me, you sing with the Mystics, prove it. So I had a card in my backpack and I pull it out with the picture, you know, it says Mystics on the card. And he says, how would you like two in the third row center? And I said, get out of here. And he said, wow. You know, and I said, wow, you know, is that the way it works? And he goes, yeah, pretty much. So we went that night and whatever. And then during the intermission, one of the matrons comes over to me, very similar story as yours, and says, are you the guy that sings with the Mystics? And I said, yeah. She says, Bob Gaudio would like to invite you backstage. And I did go backstage, and I took pictures with Christian Hoff and John Lloyd Young and whatever and whatever. And we'll see. I'm actually looking at a letter that I got from John Lloyd Young's manager, and I'm looking at the email right now, and it says, John Lloyd Young will do an interview with you, but we want you to play songs from his new album, My Turn. Check it out on CD Baby. And let me know if you want to proceed with John. Signed, you know, and his manager. And I'm saying to myself, that's good because I'd love to get him on the show. I mean, he's going to be a hot item now. Regardless of how Jersey Boy does, you know, he's the star and was, of course, the best Frankie that they had. And right. A little bit of trivia about John Lloyd Young. When Chaz Palminteri first did A Bronx Tale off Broadway, John Lloyd Young played the part of C, his son, in the off-Broadway production, of course, not a singing role. And then, as we know, the guy that did it in the movie is in jail for, is doing a life sentence for murder.
That's right. In fact, he asked Chaz for help, and Chaz said, don't bother me. Right. I don't want to be involved in this at all.
Let me ask you this. Is there anything that either one of you would like to talk about?
Sincerely and honestly, what I got out of the radio show in the long run was, even when the radio show was over, I still had the opportunity to have Rick McCaffrey as a friend. He is a wonderful person. He's honest. He's loyal. He's sensitive. And lots of times when I would be having a lousy week or a lousy day or personal problems or upset about something, Rick was always there for me. And I'm lucky to get such a great friendship out of a radio show that continued as a friendship even when the show ended.
I appreciate that. And, you come to the end of a show like that and you do it for so many years, and then all of a sudden it's over, and, radio has changed. Management changes from time to time. The format kind of, they don't believe in the format anymore, and the next thing you know is the show is over. And after doing it for so many years, and for me, I was on the radio for 40 years, which I, and then you miss it for a while, but then after a while you think to yourself, if you were to do it over again, or if it were to start up today, and somebody said, come on back, let's start the Solid Gold Jukebox again, would it be the same? And the answer is no, because you're never going to be able to duplicate the excitement of the audience of what it was like when we were actually doing the show. It was just one of those things, and it's kind of progressed beyond that now, I think, as far as you go back and you try to do what you did. It just wouldn't be the same. So I'm thinking that maybe it's a good thing that we're not back doing the show on a regular basis anyway. Once in a while would be nice, but on a regular basis, I don't think we could duplicate them. We certainly wouldn't have the same people to interview. And I can remember when we, in the prime, when we were doing that show, when 6 o'clock came, 5 minutes before six, when the guy that was on before me, when he was signing off, and he would say, Solid Gold Jukebox is next, the phone lines would start to light up, request lines. And it would, and for the next 6 hours, those request lines just were constantly lit. You'd be taking one call after another call after another call after another call, taking requests from listeners. And that, to me, was the best part of the show, because being able to connect with the listeners, and we developed with certain listeners, only through the radio. Some people we never met in person, but we had a relationship with these people, and they would call week in and week out with different requests, and you knew that there was a special memory attached to each song that you were playing for these people. And as I mentioned earlier, that was, for me, is what the show was really all about, is the music and the connection that people have with the music. And so it was a lot of fun. It was a blast.
Yip, 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 yip.
Senior prom. Now
in love with Darlene. Well, all of my life I have dreamed of Darlene.
Because
Well, you know, being invited on the show so many times, I mean, it really did a lot for me. And it was like you could go to that place that was just that special place where you didn't have to worry about the problems of the world or what was going on in your personal life or any of that other stuff. You just get lost in the music and lost in the moment. It was a really exciting thing. And the other thing I want to say about the Solid Gold Jukebox is the fact that your studio was such a state-of-the-art studio, there isn't anything that that couldn't be done there. When you compare it to the three microphones that they had, you know, at CBS-FM, it was almost antiquated there compared to the fact that no matter what needed to be done in your studio, you could go make a copy of a tune in 2 seconds. You could go edit the show in 2 seconds. You know, it was a very, very state-of-the-art studio.
We were very proud of that, and the fact that we, you know, for a local Mid-Hudson Valley station, not a major city station, we had two of the best engineers in the business, and they...
Dave Groth, Tom Morgan.
Dave Groth and Tom Morgan, I just ran into them like 2 nights ago.
With your car?
No, at a restaurant. We talked for a while, and they're you know, they're still involved in radio, but they've branched out now. You know, they're also doing some contracting with New York City stations or whatever, but they're the two best in the business, and they actually designed that construction of those new studios, and they thought of everything. So it was really a wonderful opportunity to work in a studio like that.
I'm very much against voice tracking and not having the jock live in the studio to give you the time and the weather, and if, God forbid, there's a hurricane or an earthquake, you have to go to Associated Press or the ABC, CBS, NBC network. There's nothing like having the jock in the studio communicating with the listener. The jock loves the listeners, and the listeners love the jock and the music. It is so different to have voice tracking and do the goddamn 6-hour show in 2 hours. And being in the business, I could tell probably most of the people out there listening, if they're not involved in show business, don't know what they're doing, but I find that as a turnoff. If there's a hurricane this afternoon, I don't want Associated Press or CNN covering it. I want to know what's happening in Kingston, what's happening in Westchester County, what's happening in Poughkeepsie. Make sure that Rick's house didn't disappear, that my house didn't disappear.
Absolutely.
And that, you know, but the nature of the business today, that's not possible because of financial constraints. They're not making the advertising revenue that they once did because there's so many other things that weren't available back in the old days when it was all live jocks on the radio, and they were making quite a bit in advertising revenue. There's just a lot more pulling at that dollar. So, you know, from a financial standpoint, they can't afford to have somebody live in the studio 24 hours a day.
Well,
and then there was those nights you remember when midnight would come and the person that was supposed to relieve you at midnight didn't show up.
Yeah.
So those are the nights you would be thankful for voice tracking.
Rick plays down about missing it, but I know that sometimes when he's home counting his money, he gets nostalgic. He gets into the theme, and he wishes he was doing the radio instead of counting his millions.
The business has changed quite a bit, but you know, I'm talking to two of the guys that really spent their entire adult lives enhancing this genre of music and bringing the music out to their fans. And, you know, you still have fans. I'm going to ask you this question in a crazy way. What would you say to those fans who were devout, Solid Gold Jukebox listeners who listened to you guys, you know, every time you were on the air and are still horrified by the fact that you're not on and followed you all those years? What would you say to those people?
Well, I would say, first of all, I would just thank them because they were the inspiration for the show. I mean, you know this as a disc jockey, especially when you're doing a live show every week. you feed off the energy of the audience. And then when you're a performer, it's the same way. When you're out on stage, and, you know, not having any musical ability myself or to be able to sing or whatever, I have never really had that experience other than announcing, you know, introducing, you know, performers on stage. But you do feed off the energy of the crowd, and it's the same thing as a disc jockey when you're doing a live show, especially when it's a call-in show and people are calling in with requests. You feed off the energy of the callers,
right,
and of the show. And I would just thank people for that, because that's what made made the show so special for me, is just
right,
being able to interact with them on a week-to-week basis.
Right.
I would thank Rick, first of all, for letting me be part of the Solid Gold Jukebox and the broadcasting team of Dr. Rick McCaffrey and Gary Lee Schwartz. I would thank the listener for appreciating what we did and how we did it. And I would tell the listener how much I love and respect them, and thank them for giving Rick and I the opportunity to be Rick and Gary Lee, and to be performers, entertainers, and human beings. We had people calling up with personal problems, and we could be a psychologist one day, and we could be just a complete human being that doesn't get carried away with what we're doing. It never went to our head. It still doesn't go to our head. We love the listeners for letting us do the show for them.
Well, you guys are great together. You were great together. And I really cherish this opportunity for the three of us to get together and spend the time and reminisce and talk about the music and talk about great times. Now, Gary, you have something going on right now musically that you might want to tell everybody about.
Well, Gary Lee Schwartz Music Management, what I'm doing is I'm representing two worldwide songwriters, Dr. Brian Manassian and William Rich, and we have some great songs that I'm pitching to artists, music publishers for co-publishing deals, country, pop, rock and roll managers and agents. Right. Things are looking really good. We have a Christmas song out there that some major artists will be recording. I just don't know who yet. A lot of it I owe to my lovely wife, Jacqueline. A lot of it I owe to Dr. Rick McCaffrey for his friendship, for his feedback, and a lot of things that the Mike Miller has done for Gary Lee and Rick McCaffrey through the years. If anyone wants to contact me and wants to know anything about my management company, Manassian Rich, who are outstanding songwriters, and I predict big things for them in the next year or two. Gary Lee Schwartz 1@AOL.com. I'll even give my personal phone number, 845-336-0506.
It's been great talking to you guys. I love you both, and I wish you guys a great year, and it should be all great music in your life, and it's just great to be friends with both of you.
Well, we feel the same way about you.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Michael. Bye.
Ciao.
Bye.
Sit back and listen to the Solid Gold Jukebox.
Al, send in the first line.
Oldies 97.7.
Rick McCaffrey, my good buddy Gary Lee, is here with me tonight.
What a show tonight, Doc.
It's just terrific.
Incredible experience. The phone is ringing off the hook.
Well, it's just
and
great.
How I wish you were here.
Hey.
that we used to go. When we were feeling down and we were low, we looked into each other's eyes and found the road that led us to Harmony Street. It a big surprise to find we really cared. We looked into each other's heart and found the road was free and clear to Harmony Street. Yes, there were times when we had it all. Then there were times when we both had our doubts. But through it all, you know, our love was complete. We spent all our time on Harmony Street. We couldn't believe our eyes when we were there. Wasn't it a big surprise to find we really cared? We looked into each other's eyes and found the road that led us to Harmony Street. Yes, there were times when we had it all. Times when we both had our doubts, but through it all, you know, our love was complete. We spent all our time on Harmony Street.
Open up your heart.